Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
And good day. It's Backbeat Radio on HealthyLife.net. Jay Cruz checking in. And today we're going to, well, we won't be talking about music so much, but kind of getting into some cool history and things that society maybe needs to know. I'm going to be talking about something happening in the 1700s, what led up to it, and the aftermath. Our guest today is Stephen P. Locke. He's a retired curator of history for the Ohio Historical Society. He also served in the U.S. National Guard, then taught history in Granville, Ohio, exempted school district, and studied at both undergrad and graduate level at The Ohio State University. Go Buckeyes. They had a nice win against Notre Dame last week on the last play of the game. We're talking today about the book from Stephen called War Along the Wabash, the Ohio Indian Confederacy's destruction of the U.S. Army in 1781. And as I was just mentioning to Stephen before we get started here, it's definitely a historical piece of history that I don't think anyone really knows of unless they've kind of done a deep dive into some of this history, and definitely had a big moment back in 1791 for sure, and there was a lot of aftermath that came from it. This book is also the result of 30 years research and kind of puts the battle and all the historical things that were leading up to, both from the Ohio Indian Confederacy, which was a number of tribes, and the United States at the time looking to expand. I mean, they just finished winning the Revolutionary War, and, you know, why stop here? So they're feeling high and mighty, wanted to expand. And Stephen, thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate you being here. And, you know, number one, this obviously turned into a passion or an obsession for you to go ahead and check out and check into and do the research for 30 years of research. I doubt there's any stones left unturned about this battle. And is there?
Not really. You know, it's one of those things where one diary led to another, one book led to another, one article led to another.
Mm-hmm.
I was hired to teach Ohio history in 1987. And I did some background reading, and one of the authors I read was Alan Eckert, who wrote The Frontiersman and a number of books. And he talked about St. Clair's defeat, and I actually used his books in class. I'd read excerpts to my students, you know, just to keep their attention. But I wasn't familiar with the Battle of the Wabash, and having read it and bringing it up with other people, very few people had ever heard of it. And so I started reading further about it, and after graduate school, when I started working at the Historical Society, I had an opportunity to really study the battle in earnest. And then after I retired, that lasted about a week before I decided I needed to do something, and I thought that would be kind of interesting to really focus in on that. And that took me about 10 years of research and reading and traveling to the various sites and then writing the book.
Well, that's really cool that you're able to travel to some of the various sites. When you got to some of these places, were you able to pick up like a vibe or an energy of like, you know, something big happened here back in the day?
Yes and no. I mean, the more you know, the more I suspect you feel that way. In the 90s, while I was a curator at the Historical Society, the Society operates 60 sites across the state, and we would write exhibit scripts. And, you know, when we change exhibits, we'd go through and put in new artifacts and write exhibit scripts and get a visit and meet historians who familiar with the area. So I got to walk the battlefield in the 90s, but it wasn't till after I retired it and I started really deciding to go ahead and write an account of the campaign that I went. And it's so much time has passed, and you know, there's been so much physical alteration of the lake at Fort Recovery, which was built in 1793-1794, a couple years after the battle, on the site of St. Clair's defeat. You know, there's a town there, Fort Recovery, Ohio, but they do a great job. They have a nice museum, and you can still walk the battlefield. They have great exhibits, great displays. They have a historian on staff, so there's still a lot you can get out of it. And then it was special, the images for the book, going to West Virginia and some various places in Ohio where they have statuary of the different, like Little Turtle and Captain Pipe, things like that. So it was really neat doing that.
And you're a pretty much a lifetime resident of the state of Ohio, correct?
Yeah. Born. My parents were educators. My dad was a high school football coach and a science teacher. My mom taught first grade, and then I went to school, public school, and then Ohio State University, and served in the Ohio Army National Guard. So yeah, I'm a Buckeye through and through.
Yeah. It seems like there's a lot of great museums in Ohio about Native American Indian history, and man, you got the Football Hall of Fame too. So
yep,
it's a good place to go on a little vacation and check out some museums and stuff like that. So Stephen, the date November 4th, 1791 is the day that this happened, and well, there's a lot leading up to it. Obviously, the natives, the Indians, had a confederacy to kind of keep the Americans from expanding west of the Appalachians, and the United States was very eager to expand past the Appalachians, both for the land ownership, which was a big buzz and something that the European settlers and early Americans were very interested in, because Europe didn't have a lot of those options, and obviously animal and wildlife trading as well. And it was Arthur St. Clair who led that army into the Battle of 1791, November 4th. What were some of the, bigger motivating factors for the United States, to go there? Was it just...
Absolutely. After the war, the U.S. was absolutely broke. And the according to the Treaty of Paris, which ended the war in 1783... The British were supposed to evacuate the ports, their forts, excuse me, in the upper Northwest, which they never did. They wanted a buffer state that was inhabited by the native tribes to make sure that the fur trade was not interrupted. And they didn't think the United States was going to last long anyway. One of the few sources of revenue for the U.S. after the war was the sale of lands. They got this vast territory between the Mississippi and the Appalachians following the war, but it was only on paper. Also, once the war was over, I compare it to at a track meet when someone fires a starter pistol, because people just, between 1783 and 1788, 50,000 Americans rushed into the Ohio Valley. And it was such an immediate onslaught of people, and there was so much pressure brought by the United States to purchase the land or move the native tribes out of the area, that a coalition of warriors, and they were very few in number, a lot of the various tribes could see the writing on the wall and moved into Spanish territory and west of the Mississippi. But those who stayed were hardcore warriors determined to keep white settlements south of the Ohio River, and that's why I call it the Ohio Indian Confederacy. They used the Ohio River as their boundary. They sent formal letters to Congress asking the Americans to respect that, but the Americans couldn't have stopped it even had they wanted to. It was so far away from Philadelphia, which was the capital at the time. And there was just so many people moving north of the Ohio River that the Confederacy just started attacking isolated settlements and settlers and trying as best they could to deny them access to the area.
And you also, you know, mentioned there the natives' method of attack was literally sometimes, you know, picking on maybe a small area or a couple people who were isolated a little bit, almost like if you're watching a National Geographic, how the lion or the attacking animal will find the kind of the straggler that's not around the pack, and then they would sometimes maybe try to get them to assimilate into the tribe, or, you know, other times just outright murder and torture.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. The Americans, our military history is so intertwined with the type of warfare waged by Native Americans. I mean, in the Second World War, MacArthur talked about hitting the Japanese. He called it hitting them where they ain't. Instead of attacking a reinforced position, they would go to some small garrison and overwhelm it. And that's the Native tribes talked about warfare to them was the art of the ambush. And it was fascinating reading about it because almost anybody who had any dealings with them wrote over and over again just how impressed they were with their military capabilities. You know, you couldn't hear them, couldn't see them. They wouldn't, if there was no shame, if there was a large force moving upon an Indian village, they wouldn't attack it. They would melt away. And so if you moved into Indian territory and you divided your forces, you're going to be in a world of hurt. And that's what happened. The attacks got so bad that the commander of the 1st American Regiment, Josiah Harmer, wrote letter after letter saying, you know, the only way to stop these attacks is to have a military campaign against their stronghold, which was in Kekianga, which is Fort Wayne, Indiana. And he went up there and he divided his force twice, and he paid for it. He had 183 people killed, 183 soldiers, a lot of regulars. And he came back and he had to face a court-martial. And so they decided to send a second army to Kekianga, and this time they appointed Arthur St. Clair, and his job was to march all the way from the Ohio River up to Fort Wayne, Indiana, and build a string of fortifications along the way. And then when he got to Kekianga, which was the Blackberry Patch, it's a village of Miami and Shawnee villages, a complex of villages, he was to build a mighty fortress there to awe them. And it didn't work out well.
Yeah, it seems like they, you know, even getting to that point, it seems like it took a long time to get there. I mean, obviously, they were on horseback. They didn't have tanks, cars, or military jets or helicopters to kind of move them. And even at that time, communication was synonymous with basically transportation. There was no telephone, certainly no text messages or, you know.
Right.
And even the natives usually, they communicated, as you know, we often hear about the legendary smoke signals that they use was sometimes the quickest method. But didn't it take St. Clair's troops like a couple of months to move from like Pennsylvania to the area in Ohio?
Absolutely. They moved along what was called the Forbes Road, which was just a narrow ribbon of mud that moved east to west across the state of Pennsylvania until they got to Fort Pitt. And then at Fort Pitt, they took flatboats down the Ohio River until they got to Fort Washington, which is Cincinnati today. But they averaged about 2 to 3 miles on the road an hour, so maybe 10 to 15 miles a day. So it took St. Clair a month just to do the first leg of the journey to Fort Pitt. And it was a saying of the time, it was easier to move 1,000 miles over water than 100 miles over land. And that certainly proved the case. Once they got to Fort Pitt, they covered 93 miles in like a day and a half. But the trip from Carlisle, Pennsylvania, or from New Brunswick, New Jersey, all the way to Fort Pitt on the Forbes Road was just unbelievably slow and tough. And it took months and months to assemble the army.
And during that time, it's mentioned here in the book that the Ohio Confederacy was able to, well, they certainly weren't surprised when the time that St. Clair and the army showed up. They had a long time to kind of scout and see what was happening, and sort of had knowledge of this migration of the army almost the entire time.
Absolutely. One of the things I really enjoyed about researching the book was the opportunity to read the captivity narratives. And not just people from Ohio. Mary Rowlandson wrote a captivity narrative. She was captured in the 17th century, in the 1600s. And James Smith was a Pennsylvanian, and he was captured in 1754. He lived 4 years with the Seneca Cayuga, and he was just astonished at their military capabilities. And he was never denied the opportunity to write in his journal. And it terrified him that the tribes were underestimated, especially with the Americans having won the Revolutionary War, very confident, very arrogant. They wanted to dictate a peace, and he told anybody who would listen, you know, they are not a stupid people. When we sent armies into their area, they outgeneraled us and defeated us, and when they came into our enemy in our area, they did the same thing. And they could move with hand signals, very complex formations, and encircle entire armies or just a small encampment. They were absolutely ruthless. You know, they weren't, you know, it was terrifying if you were a European and you were captured, you might be ransomed, you might be adopted into the tribe, or you might be tortured terribly, horribly. So they were a formidable opponent. They were just absolutely, you know, they were inured to hardship. They knew the rivers and the streams. They spent their lives hunting, and, you know, that activity kind of qualified them for warfare. And the people like William Johnson, who was the superintendent of Indian Affairs, also tried to warn people. He wrote in his diary during Pontiac's uprising, just that there was no better troops in the world than these Indian warriors. So it was the fact that the Americans took them so lightly, considering what the result would be if they lost, if you were captured, is just amazing to me that they didn't take it more seriously than they did.
Yeah, it really is. And you definitely said, Stephen, that the Americans at that time, they're probably feeling a little high and mighty. They just defeated the mighty British army. And
yep.
In a lot of ways, historically, you know, the nation or the army that's invading for, you know, personal gain, you know, for land, for riches, for, you know, resources and stuff, in this case, land and the wildlife that was available, the fur trade and stuff like that. You know, while they're trying to take something, the folks that are defending definitely seem to have the advantage. And number one, they're more inspired to protect their land, livelihood, and way of life. They know the terrain a lot better. And in this case, you know, the Indians had been native to America for a lot longer than at this point the Americans, who are maybe a couple generations from the 1600s, you know, on this continent, where the tribes that had been here, they've always been here, and this was their way of life. So, it was arrogance to overlook the advantage that they seem to have.
That's a good sentence there. It was their way of life. It really was. I mean, it was one of the professors I quote in the book says, you know, warfare between the tribes was endemic. It was constant. It was unrelenting. So it was a way of life, just like you said. And then as the Europeans arrived, they sided with the French, they sided with the British, some tribes sided with the Americans. So, I mean, their way of life was warfare, and mm-hmm. they knew how to conduct it. And they were just an absolutely formidable enemy. They destroyed more Americans on the Wabash in 3 hours than any number of Americans in any battle between 1775 and 1783 during the American Revolutionary War. So it was a huge mistake to underestimate them.
No, absolutely. And, you know, for a lot of folks that look into Native American history now, they sometimes don't understand that there's so many different tribes, meaning they didn't exactly agree on everything. They're migratory people, and, yeah, they would go to war at the drop of a hat, and it was a way of life. And they fought amongst themselves, and it took something like the Americans in expansion to really bring them together, at least for maybe a short period of time, to call off any differences they had within each other. Because obviously, if they didn't have such differences, they would have all been kind of one united, bigger nation instead of the various tribes, which were sizable, but not as sizable as they could have been had they all been united as a full-on Native nation.
Yeah, there's a great book, Tecumseh and the Quest for, Native American Leadership by R. David Edmonds. It came out in the 1980s. And he argues that, you know, one of the things that the contact with Europeans changed both cultures. And he said it never would have occurred to the tribes of the interior to, like Tecumseh did, and the Miami under Little Turtle, and the Shawnee under Blue Jacket, and the Congahelas of the Delaware. They wanted to form a coalition, but R. David Edmonds argues that that probably wouldn't have happened to such an extent prior to European contact, you know, because they were so fiercely tribal, they were constantly at war with one another. But the threat they faced after the American Revolutionary War was so vast, so immediate. At that time, the American population was doubling every 25 years, and the Native population was being reduced by half about every 20 years. So it was just an onslaught, and the way to respond to it was to set aside their differences and to form the coalition. And it wouldn't have been as successful if not for the British forts in the Northwest. The British were there on the scene. They were supplying them with food. They were supplying them with ammunition, with encouragement. So that absolutely helped the Confederacy. But it was a real departure from what the usual way that they waged war. Both in 1791, between 1790 and 1795, during the Ohio Indian Wars, and then with Tecumseh during the War of 1812.
Thank you for the reference of that book. I'm going to have to pick that up sometime soon from R. David Edmonds. What was the title again?
Yeah. Tecumseh and the Quest for Indian Leadership or Native American Leadership. I can't remember. It's been years since I read it. But I was struck by that comment that never would have occurred to me until I had read his book, that he said, you know, it was the fact that there was a coalition at all indicated just how much the Native tribes had been affected by contact with the Europeans, whether it was French, English, or the Americans.
No, absolutely. And a book I read many years ago, and have probably read three times at least, by James Alexander Thom called Panther in the Sky, which is sort of almost a historical biography and, you know, in storytelling fashion about the life and times of Tecumseh, his brother who became the prophet and Prophet Town, and all of the stories there. And, you know, kind of describes that, you know, he did a lot of pilgrimages to other tribes to kind of get them to quit signing treaties and unite. So we're going to talk more about Tecumseh in a little bit. I know he's mentioned a couple times in the book. And we're going to take a quick break right now here on Backbeat Radio. Today our guest is Stephen Locke, and the book is War Along the Wabash, and that can be found at all the usual places, Barnes & Noble, or possibly your local library. You can go in and ask for that, or your favorite local bookstore. You can probably order it through them. And if you're a fan of this type of history and research, I suggest you get it. It's a very informative, very historical. And again, 30 years of research, it's pretty factual and some good stuff. We're going to take a quick break right now on Backbeat Radio and be back with Stephen Locke right after this.
What would happen if you didn't follow the established path? Would you feel scared or proud? Could you explain that helping the people of Peru improve their own community would also have an effect on your own? Would you rather make your own way or spend a lifetime saying, what if? Life is calling. How far will you go? Peace Corps. To find out more, call 1-800-424-8580 or go to peacecorps.gov.
Roku is like having your own video library with over 300,000 choices. And it's the best way to get Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, and so much more. There's a Roku player for every budget, so go to HealthyLife.net's advertiser page and click on the Roku banner.
And thanks for tuning in. Thanks for staying tuned today to Backbeat Radio. If you just joined us, our guest is Stephen Locke, Stephen P. Locke. He is the author of War Along the Wabash, and it's a story about the Ohio Indian Confederacy's destruction of the U.S. Army, 1791, and a lot of stuff that was leading up to that, both from the Native Confederacy and from the United States, which was, at that time, a very young, arrogant, and eager to expand country. Before the defeat of the British in the Revolutionary War, seemed like the British just wanted to stick to the 13 colonies and not really expand, but more people came over, the population was growing, and, well, we needed more space, apparently, was the mindset of the United States. So thanks for being here, Stephen, and welcome back.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
No, for sure. So we left off with a story about kind of one of my favorite historical characters, and we'll reference him again later, Tecumseh, who was a Shawnee chief, and also an individual who was very steadfast behind the let's stick together as a confederacy of natives, as opposed to maybe chiefs that were very willing to sign treaties, which certainly didn't go too good for the native and the Indian confederacies at that time. Now, on the U.S. side, Arthur St. Clair was the guy who was chosen to lead this expedition into the war. And he's a guy who's pretty interesting historically that I hadn't really heard of before checking out the book, Stephen. There was a lot to St. Clair, wasn't there?
There was. It's interesting you said that, because I mentioned in the introduction of the book that when I mentioned the Battle of the Wabash, people looked at me like, you know, what are you talking about? And when, if you, for example, if you get a book about, you know, the 10 greatest military defeats in U.S. history, it was never mentioned, which was just astonishing to me after doing, you know, research on the book. And then you mentioned just real quickly on Tecumseh, one of the ways he illustrated that when he was trying to get a tribe or a clan to join the Confederation, his Confederation, he would show him a stick and break it in half and say, look how easy that was. And then he would put, you know, 30 sticks together and say, now try to break it how we're stronger together, that type of thing. But yeah, Arthur St. Clair, he was a Scotsman born in 1737. He trained to be a physician in London. He went to the University of Edinburgh, then he went to London to train to be a physician. But when his mom passed away, in 1756, he got a small inheritance, and he used it to buy a commission in the British Army. And that was during the Seven Years' War. He almost immediately crossed the Atlantic, took part in the wars of North America, the Siege of Louisbourg, and then the Battle of Quebec, where he picked up a stand of fallen colors during a horrendous battle in which both commanders, Montcalm and Wolfe, were killed. He was promoted. He was very handsome, very dashing. He was a gentleman. He went to Boston and met a beautiful woman, Phoebe Baird, who was well-connected. Her dad was a wealthy businessman. Her uncle was the governor of the Massachusetts colony. And they wed, and he got a substantial endowment. And he resigned his commission and became a judge in the far western country. And then, you know, had a family, built a mine, built a mill, was a you know, converted into an American over the next 10, 15 years. And when the war broke out, he was a Scot, and his wife was sympathetic to the rebel cause, and he threw in with the rebels and fought throughout the Revolutionary War. So, yeah.
And then he also became governor. Was it somewhere in Pennsylvania or a certain territory?
Yeah, he was, you know, he was George Washington always wanted to get a commission in the British Army, and he never did.
Uh-huh.
And St. Clair was a commissioned officer, and, you know, Washington respected that. And St. Clair took part in the invasion of Canada. He got up there, and the American Army had already been defeated. But he kept his head. He knew how to handle troops. He did a good job in a disastrous situation, and so Washington had him come down to his army in New York, but it was just at the time they were being defeated and chased across New Jersey. So St. Clair was actually a brigade commander that crossed the Delaware with Washington Christmas 1776.
Wow.
And after they defeated the Hessians at Trenton, the local British formations rose up and were going to attack them the following morning. It was actually St. Clair who suggested a night march and an attack on Princeton. And it went well. They eluded the British. And Washington at that point just trusted him absolutely. And he was appointed Major General, one of only 35 Major Generals throughout the whole war, and one of only five from Pennsylvania. So his star was definitely on the rise. And when the Americans switched from short-term enlistments to a standing army, a Continental Army in 1777, St. Clair did not really get to command any one of those branches because he was ordered to Fort Ticonderoga as commander of that installation in late June 1777. And unfortunately, he was there just about 3 weeks when an enormous British Hessian army surrounded the place, and he had to abandon the post. He was outflanked. Any kind of scout that he sent out never came back because there were just so many British and their Indian allies in the woods, and he lost the fortification. And the fortification had such a emotional, it gave the colonists a sense of security because it was on an invasion route for Ticonderoga that the Algonquins had attacked the Americans for years coming through there. And once they occupied that fort, they felt secure. And when St. Clair abandoned it, all hell broke loose. He was ridiculed. He was charged with cowardice. He had to face a court-martial. And it was just absolutely devastating. It was a true watershed moment in his life. And I argue in the book that's one of the reasons he pushed so hard, even when in 1791 enlistments were expiring, the men were on quarter rations, they were far from their base of supply, but he just kept pushing and pushing and pushing because I really believe that it was devastating what he went through. The ridicule, the attacks on him in the press, being charged with cowardice in court, it really affected him. And I think that's why he wanted the command in 1791, and that's why he continued to push when he really should have consolidated his gains and stopped.
Yeah, definitely sounds like there was a little bit of a bruised ego with the everything kind of backlash, the press at the time, which, you know, was questioning his leadership or strategy or whatever. It seemed like he sort of knew when to kind of cut his losses, which is not a bad thing, but apparently there were, you know, times he was in a bad position, especially with Fort Ticonderoga. But having already established himself in a close relationship with Washington, who that guy's kind of the ultimate founding father and first president, obviously, and many of the other signers of the Declaration of Independence, and apparently was in the Freemason as well, as many of the signers were. So, it seems like maybe they sort of still believed in him. You know, Hamilton, Adams, Franklin, Washington, and people of that ilk, where they maybe understood more of the long picture of what was going on, and then he was able to convince them you know, to kind of do it. As you mentioned, the number of troops was diminishing, and that, you know, might have been from a point where the Americans at the time were kind of really just trying to establish their own independence and really not so concerned about expansion.
Yeah, the government had to sell the land in the Northwest Territory in order to survive, and they had to get it surveyed, and they had to have it sold to people who would actually pay instead of squatters. And so that's where their interests were in revenue, really. They didn't care one way or another who was occupying the area at the time. They wanted to sell it so they wouldn't go bankrupt and collapse. It's interesting, there was a Gouverneur Morris wrote that, you know, when St. Clair abandoned Fort Ticonderoga, he said the condemnation rang from one end of the continent to the other. And John Adams was so upset that he wrote in his diary, "We're never going to keep a fort until we shoot a general," which was, I mean, to give you an idea how upset his fellow Americans were that Ticonderoga was abandoned. So, I mean, it really had an impact on him.
I guess in modern day history, you might even tie in the exodus of Afghanistan and how a lot of people reacted to that. I mean,
yes.
Just, you know, leaving behind a lot of equipment and and maybe not finishing what the original goal was to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
And just kind of a quick sidebar on St. Clair. Was he a signee of the Declaration of Independence?
No, he was not.
Okay. That's probably why he's semi-languishing in obscurity.
Right. He was appointed, in the Confederated Congress before the Constitution was ratified. In the Confederated Congress, he was actually voted as president, and he's the only foreign-born president to ever serve in that capacity. And then he was the first governor of the Northwest Territory, which is like 260,000 square miles, you know, Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, Illinois. He was governor of the entire area for 15 years. So he led quite a life.
Yeah, that's interesting that that was called the Northwest Territory when initially I would think Boston, you know, Connecticut,
right.
Massachusetts, and what we currently call New England, which is the ultimate Northwest. But once the colonies were established as the nation, it seemed like the Northwest was now in the new expansion in the Appalachian Territory. So we're talking with Stephen Locke, author of War Along the Wabash, which, of course, is available at many of the places you normally would find books, Barnes & Noble, maybe your local library. Of course, that huge company that makes a lot of money, that starts with an A. And kind of one of my new favorites, Audible, for those that are into listening to the Audible version or great narrators. Like, I'm a promoter of books. I kind of read a few myself occasionally, but it's always sometimes great to have a great narrator tell you the story, and this seems like it might lend itself pretty well to the Audible. How did your process go in selecting a narrator? Was that something that you did or the publisher?
Yeah, the Casemate, which is the publisher, and the book came out in April of this year, 2023. It's not even been out 6 months yet. It became a featured selection of the Military History Book Club. And then Casemate told me that Audible wanted to do it, and they said they preferred to have the author read, you know, but they had to hear me, and I thought, oh, well, they will never pick me. But I did a sample, and they did, and it was really exciting. It took 2 weeks, and we set up my den as a studio, and they sent a kit, and they had a producer and a director, and every day we'd go, like we're doing now, and I would read, and so it was a really neat experience, and I was glad I got to read it because I could put inflection and stress on things and that I felt was important, that I knew was important, having written the book myself. So it was really exciting.
Congratulations for being selected to read your own book. Sometimes that doesn't happen. They're picky, and they want to get someone with a good voice, but that person with a great voice might not, again, have the insight that you did and do with 30 years of research, being an Ohio lifetime resident, and sometimes just knowing the material and having a passion and the information can come across better. So cool that you got to do that.
Yeah, thank you. That was really exciting.
Yeah. So we're going to talk a little bit more about, you know, the history leading up to this. Obviously, the Appalachian Territory was desirable for the land expansion, and for many years, the folks in Canada were doing quite well in getting like beaver pelts and other furs, and able to transfer just tons of this back to Europe, especially in France.
Yeah, the fur trade really it was such a shock. You hear the term culture shock. I mean, the arrival of Europeans and then this insatiable demand for beaver pelts, for fur coats and fur hats in Europe. You know, the Iroquois ended up waging war on their neighbors to the south and to the west because they wanted to control the fur trade. And that was a huge upheaval, a change. And, you know, they just decimated the beaver populations. But it was the tribes themselves who would go out and trap the beaver and then sell the pelts. And, of course, they soon discovered that they had a low tolerance for alcohol. So a lot of there were obviously fair traders, but almost immediately alcohol was used to subvert clans and tribes and get as many furs as they possibly could without, you know, out giving up much other than whiskey and rum but it was a huge enterprise. And just like you said, they were shipping tons of pelts across the Atlantic. There's a book called Fur Fortune and Empire. I can't remember the author. I read it for the book, and it was a great book. And it just talked about Americans never seemed to do anything small. It was just like this massive, you know, it's like the bison at one point. There were 60 to 80 million bison, and we almost killed them all. So it was the same type of thing, just devastating. And lucrative. I mean, that's why it was devastating. You just made so much money, and they shipped so many pelts across the Atlantic. And when you read Fur Fortune and Empire, and he's got all the statistics, just the amount of pelts that are moving across the Atlantic Ocean is just stunning from year to year, decade to decade.
You know, with the Indians and their relationship with alcohol, or fire water, as it sometimes is referred to, it definitely devastated their thinking and their focus. And obviously their blood type or bodies were not able to handle it as well as others. And it's something that the population of Native Americans certainly still deal with today, but you trace it back. And it certainly did cloud their judgment in a lot of ways, and certainly made them more aggressive at times when it came to war or they were going on their attacks.
Yeah, the missionaries, pretty much anybody that came in contact, discovered, you know, they write in their diaries, both French, English, well, not both, but all French, English, and Americans, all noted just how addicted, how fond they were of alcohol. And it didn't take long for people to use alcohol to get what they wanted. I mentioned James Smith, and he talked about just how, you know, if alcohol arrived in camp, if whiskey arrived in camp, they would sell everything they had to get their hands on it. It was, you know, there was West Indian rum, there was French brandy, but during the conflict with Great Britain, there was an embargo, and so more and more pot stills were being, you know, Americans brewed their own, made their own, distilled their own whiskey. And there was just tons of it. And it's another thing that completely transformed, you know, up to that time, the Indians brewed alcohol, but it was low in alcoholic content. And it was, you know, it dissipated very quickly, but there was just a river of whiskey being poured into the Northwest Territory. And if you look at even the British kept accurate records at, you know, like Fort Detroit and Fort Michilimackinac, and it was just unbelievable. You know, like 19,000 gallons a year for one fort, that type of thing. So it was used to get what they wanted, and they did.
Absolutely. And, yeah, well, alcohol, it's not just something that can be detrimental to Native and Indians population, but yeah, anyone who overindulges for sure could run into problems and issues, or definitely change in their outlook or mindset. We're going to take...
You know, and the Catholic priests, the Quakers in Pennsylvania, they all urge, and the chiefs themselves, a lot of different, Iroquois chiefs, you know, they pled with the Americans or the English or the French to stop a lot of Indians recognized what was happening and tried to curtail the practice, but it was just impossible to do over such a huge area.
And especially when they certainly had an appetite for it, and sounds like the Indians weren't saying no. They were certainly accepting and very desirable of alcohol, you know, for what it made them feel.
Yeah, there's a chapter in the book called Alcohol, Demographics, and Disease, just to give the reader an idea of just how the long odds that the Confederacy faced at the time. They had been so decimated by alcohol and disease, and then the demographics was clearly on the side of the Europeans. So they really faced long odds, and the fact that they destroyed St. Clair's army, it was astonishing at the time, and it's amazing in retrospect.
Absolutely. I think when we come back, Stephen, let's talk a little bit about the actual war on the Wabash and some of the aftermath, and if we can touch on a little bit with your involvement in the Ohio Historical Society.
Sounds great.
All right. We're going to take a quick break here on Backbeat Radio and be back in a moment with Stephen Locke, author of War Along the Wabash. It can be found at all the usual online spots, maybe your local library, local bookstore. You can order it. And I would encourage you to check out the audiobook on Audible, read by Stephen himself. We'll be right back.
I'm William Shatner, and this is Jimmy. Animals like Jimmy are often left behind by people fleeing hurricanes, fires, floods, and earthquakes. These abandoned animals cannot survive on their own. If you must evacuate your home, please never leave an animal behind. If you absolutely cannot take your animal with you, never leave him helplessly chained or caged. Many animals die because they cannot escape fires or rising waters. Animals need your help. Thank you.
Call PETA today, 757-622-PETA.
See straight and save. These days, everyone seems to see things differently. But from your eyes, you can see straight and save. Right now, get glasses online at 70% off at Glasses USA. There's a 100% guarantee, too, on top brand men, women, multifocal, and even prescription sunglasses. Visit HealthyLife.net's advertiser page and click on Glasses USA, and you will see straight and save.
To get your message out, social media is great, but if you want to be picked up by major media outlets, let's face it, just using social media makes your chances, well, slim to none. If you want to improve your chances, put your message in the right place. A press release on PR Web. Affordable, easy to use, and with great customer service, there's no reason not to use PR Web. Visit HealthyLife.net's advertiser page and click on PR Web now and get started.
All positive talk with a mature edge. HealthyLife.net.
And we're back for what's going to be the final segment today on Backbeat Radio, War Along the Wabash. It is a great historical reference and book to the Ohio Indian Confederacy's destruction of the U.S. Army, 1791, and what led up to that in the aftermath. Now, Stephen, one of the things in the aftermath of this war in which the Ohio Confederacy won quite significantly, was the bigger United States Army was formed after that, and they kept the numbers a lot higher after this defeat.
Yeah, it's interesting. After the Battle of New York, Washington, and, you know, they were so desperate, and they crossed the Delaware, and they defeated the Hessians and then the British at Princeton. But Congress decided to, you know, change from short-term enlistments to an actual army of 3 years of the duration of the war. And after both the Harmer campaign, Josiah Harmer, who went up to Kekyung in 1790, and then after St. Clair's army was destroyed, they did the same thing. They created the Legion of the United States, and they voted to keep them in uniform until such time as the Indians were defeated. So overwhelming was the defeat of St. Clair's army. So it really, you know, the idea that the Americans could get by with a system that relied on short-term enlistments was destroyed along the Wabash River along with its army. The further St. Clair's army marched, they started out in September 1791, and they had to cut their way through, you know, an ancient forest, and they had details of road cutters, and then they would stop every so often and construct a fort, which was what he was charged with doing. Those were his orders. And so he built Fort Hamilton, he built Fort Jefferson. But by the time they got all the way up to the Wabash, and they didn't know where they actually thought they were on the St. Mary's River. They were confused about where they were. They had moved further and further and further from their base of supplies to the point where the men were on like quarter flour rations. And some officers said, you know, we were almost starved. And there were constant desertions. And the second in command was not speaking. General Richard Butler was not speaking to Arthur St. Clair, and Arthur St. Clair was not speaking to him. And so they finally, the last day they marched till about 3 p.m, and they stopped to fortify. But a couple officers said there was really not enough good water close by. Let's continue the march until we get to this tributary, which was the Wabash. And so St. Clair gave the go-ahead, and they ended up marching like 9 miles that day and didn't get into their camp until after dark. And for the first time in the whole campaign, St. Clair did not order the men to entrench, to build, you know, defensive barriers around the perimeter of camp, which is just mind-boggling to me, to be that deep in enemy territory and not do that. And he didn't. And at night, a couple guys, despite that order, a couple guys started cutting trees down to put in front of the artillery emplacements, and St. Clair ordered them to stop because they didn't want men to trip and fall down in the dark over these trees. And so it was just like the perfect storm. You have all these men encamped in a tight formation, so far from their base of supply, and they didn't entrench. And then opposite them, you have the best, you know, the best fighting force in the world, 1,100 of these various tribes that had come together. And they encircled them. Within 30 minutes of launching their attack, they were surrounded. And it was, I liken it to predators trying to get a shoal of fish into a tighter and tighter compact ball. And over 3 hours, that's what happened. And when the 3 hours were up, 67% of the men were dead. Over 600 men were dead, and over 900 either dead or wounded. So it was just an absolute catastrophe.
Yeah, that, they were, you said, a perfect storm. They were definitely literally between a rock, or in this case, a tree, and a hard place. Plus,
yeah.
With morale dipping and supplies diminishing, being on rations, you know, perfect storm. And the Confederacy of the Natives had a little more inspiration to protect their turf. Again, that's kind of a common thing throughout history. The defenders who are fighting for their livelihood typically fight harder and have an advantage other than the people that are just looking to expand for their own personal gain.
There's no doubt. I mean, that army was moving closer and closer to their homes.
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, the other thing I talk about is the warriors apply war paint, which just some of the diaries of the survivors, you know, the shock of looking up and seeing, you know, they thought if they'd encounter an Indian, it'd be a small hunting party or scouting party. And they look up on the morning of November 4th, and there are literally hundreds of men who, despite it being cold, didn't have shirts on and were painted and racing toward them with hatchets and skinning knives and shooting at rifles. It was just absolutely overwhelming because they were, the surprise was absolutely complete. And it shouldn't have been because there was a patrol set out the night before, and the patrol came in contact with three different parties of Indians. And so they went and told General Butler about it, and Butler didn't tell St. Clair because they weren't speaking. So it's which is ironic because the tribes were always at war with one another, and in this instance they had set their animosities and their differences aside to come together, and the Americans were nearly at each other's throats, and the result was just an absolute devastating defeat.
Yeah. Now again, a perfect storm and outsmarted by the Confederacy. Stephen, this has been a wonderful talk about everything happening in the book, War Along the Wabash, which people can find all their favorite book outlets. But let's kind of wrap up with your involvement with the Ohio Historical Connection and what's happening there. I know a lot of stories about natives in that area of Ohio, which is certainly a hotbed at this time in American history.
Yeah, if you get a chance, the Ohio History Connection, it's located in Columbus, Ohio, operates over 60 different historical sites across the state, always putting on some type of program, an exhibit. They operate a 19th century American Civil War village, what it would be like at that time. Great programs, great people. They do readings, they do distant learning. So, and then great select in our various stores, we have great selections of books. So definitely worth checking out.
Absolutely. I'm going to have to check an online site for them.
Yeah, OhioHistoryConnection.org.
Okay. Yeah, usually that would kind of make sense. But even the couple books you mentioned in our interview, I'm going to have to find that one on Tecumseh from R. David Edmonds. And I know Ohio has a lot of history with Tecumseh and his brother and Prophet Town and a lot of stuff. And I even think Richard Butler was involved in Tecumseh's trek later on from the Panther in the Sky book. But we could literally go on for hours talking about this fascinating history, but we're just about out of time. Stephen, it's been a wonderful having you on the show today.
Thank you so much. And just real quick, there's a great biographer named Sugden, S-U-G-D-E-N, who wrote a biography of Tecumseh and one on Blue Jacket, John Sugden. So those are great, too.
All right. Stephen, this has been great. Again, for our listeners, Stephen P. Locke is the author. War Along the Wabash is the book, and all your favorite book outlets, either brick-and-mortar stores, libraries, which definitely need our continued support so we can keep literacy in the country, which, according to this book, was a kind of a rare thing at these times, too.
That's exactly right. 50% of the American population was illiterate at the time.
Yeah.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Now, this has been great. Thank you for being with us today. Again, Stephen P. Locke and War Along the Wabash, our guest for the last hour here on Backbeat Radio. Thanks again, Stephen.
Thank you.